Hello, this is Marty Mitchinson, and when I'm traveling and paddling my dugout canoe up in the headwaters of the Rio Tuira in Panama's Darien province, I like to end my day by tuning into Radio Peace International, catch up on world news and voices I trust.
This is Scott Fratcher for Radio for Peace International. Today we're going to be visiting Panama's Darien province. The Darien is home to the Hunan and the Embarra Indian tribes, listed as some of the world's least contacted people. The Darien is also home to the famous Darien Gap, a 30-mile-long no-man's zone and the reason even the most intrepid traveler cannot drive from Central America into South America. The Darien region's southern border is also the northern front in the 40-year-old civil war in Colombia. Hostilities routinely flow over the border with FARC, narco-traffickers, and paramilitary actions affecting the local inhabitants. As if that were not sufficient tensions enough, new roads are being built almost daily, allowing ranchers, loggers, poachers, and tourists to enter a small area that just a few years ago was considered accessible only by dugout canoe. We'll be talking with Martin Mitchinson, who has just returned from a year-and-a-half-long expedition into the Darien. Martin visited most of the river system headwaters by dugout canoe, a lone gringo paddling along and attempting to make sense out of a region in conflict.
Running backwards, saying that friends of theirs had been shot and that there were paramilitaries in the area.
We will also be talking to the crews of three separate sailboats on their impressions of the Darien province, including one who suffered a pirate attack and was held for 6 hours by 8 Colombian pirates with machine guns while they were forced to bring their vessel into Colombian waters.
And they bring us with a machine gun in the back. You say, now take your boat there and follow us.
And the crew of Bamboo will speak about their experiences in the Darien.
There was a turtle.
Alive.
A seed with eggs.
They cut all the meat out, but the heart was still pumping.
Lastly, we'll be talking to the crew of Farniente, who brought their catamaran into La Palma, but instead of going farther up the river, hired a ponga to bring them up to the headwaters of the Savannah River and Bocalora.
We would liken it to a National Geographic experience. That's really what it was like.
We're going to start our interviews today with the crew of Bamboo, a 31-foot warm catamaran that just returned from 6 weeks in the Darien province of Panama. So welcome to the program. And you just sailed your small boat right into the heart of the capital of the Darien province. How were you accepted by the people?
When you pointed from the kids, they loved us. Okay, kids, you know, you can come, you know, but, you know, anchor your boat over there. But there was more or less every day a big kindergarten going on.
Yeah, lots of children visiting. Yeah. Anyone who's in a boat is really well off. And as we have a very simple boat with very little modern conveniences on, they were astonished sometimes to know that we didn't have a TV or a refrigerator or a bathroom.
That was one funny part of the kayak trip. So we were really far off. We saw a dugout canoe with an outboard motor, let's say 2-3 miles, you know, and then suddenly it moved, you know. Yeah, it came slowly but intense to us, you know. Say, okay. So it wasn't there, and they didn't even say, I think, hello. They just asked, do you have television? Said, no, we don't.
And then they went away.
They
were really not interested.
And a couple of days later, we heard then there were also a couple with a catamaran. And what they did, they made once in a while video shows. And many of the Indians, you know, came with a dugout canoe. And the television was pointed on the stern, on the aft, you know, so everybody can see. There was a little, you know, floating cinema. And since, you know, they got in their mind, catamaran, couple people must have a TV.
So then you were both anchored off of La Palma, the capital city of the Darien province. And being anchored at the closest provincial capital to the Colombian border, was there a feeling of, I guess, Wild West or frontierism? And how did that make you feel?
I wouldn't say there was any kind of feeling like there is criminality going on or you have to take care about things. I mean, according to the size of the police station, yes, it was. You know, for a teeny tiny town, a huge police station with a certain kind of prison before, where you can even see the prisoners, was for me personally a certain kind of strange feeling. Mm-hmm. But
it's not a teeny tiny town. It is the capital.
It is the capital.
For that region.
Okay, but...
Even though it's small,
it
has a certain
importance.
It was
big size, you know, and yeah. Very dominant, you know.
Very dominant. And when we walked by it the first day, they wanted to have all our information, and we had to go run back to the boat and get our passports because they didn't want to wait till the next day. And, yeah, so they were telling pretty much under control everything.
Yeah.
A funny thing was with the police... When we did bring back our passports, we came around behind from the riverside, and it was a Sunday or Saturday, and there were some fishermen cleaning their catch, and there was a turtle, a sea turtle, a pretty big sea turtle with eggs. And that was happening, like, right behind the police station, and we were kind of
but
surprised.
But it was a police station, man, who were digging it out and butcher it.
It was a police officer.
And it was really an awful... They turned it on the back, you know, and they cut all the meat out, but the heart was still pumping. It was like, ooh. And when we know, you know, that it is...
Protected also, species, yeah. We were wondering... it was a little bit like the Wild West that we know in Colorado. Right here in La Palma. It felt like that kind of energy. You know, what goes on, you know, that's their country. You know, it's like, don't interfere if you're an outsider. So, you know, we just showed them our passport and we were friendly as we can be. And we just, you know.
What type of wildlife did you see in the Darien?
Dolphin. There were lots of dolphin that came in the river, especially one time, about four or five. And the river is special because there's the very marked high tide and low tide, and so there's a strong current going in and out in La Palma. And it was unusual to see, huh? Dolphin up there.
Up there, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, as I ask the kids, you know, they are coming once in a while. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
Baby shark.
Baby shark.
Which the Indians caught a lot. It was a delicacy for them at a certain time of the year, which was a couple months ago.
Cassons.
Casson. Lots of birds.
Oh, yeah.
Raptors. Hawks.
Hawks.
What else?
Yeah, and these birds, you know, would like to fish, although...
Kingfishers?
Kingfishers, yeah.
What type of artwork did you see, and how did you go about finding that artwork?
You are, you know, anchoring, and you...
Immediately, the artwork contacts you. In the form of the women, the Indian women, the... Embera, and they come with their basket, their very fine basket work, and then they weave them very, very tightly together so that the baskets can hold water, in fact, for transport.
For transport, yeah.
And they're very beautiful motifs and colors that they use, very bright color combinations sometimes. All natural fibers and all natural dyes that they find in the rainforest that surrounds them. And this is something that's being developed also, too, is as an economic possibility for the Indians, is to market their arts and crafts and handwork to the tourists that come to the region. So it's kind of promoted and well-respected there. Huh?
Well, thank you to the crew of Bamboo for their insights into the Darien region of Panama. Coming up next, we'll be speaking with Johan. Johan brought his sailboat into the Darien, but not up the river system, but instead went to the bays on the Pacific coast, down towards the coast of Colombia. Near the coast of Colombia, Johan was boarded by 8 pirates. The boat was commandeered, and Johan and his crew were forced to sail south for Colombian waters. And only by a twist of fate and fast thinking was Johan around to tell his story. Johan, welcome to the program. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
So, Johan, Johan de Cat. My father was Dutch and my mother French.
And the name of your boat?
And the name of my boat is Tarkan. Tarkan is the name of a galaxy. And I bought this boat in Tahiti now 15 years ago in a sect of ET, of extraterrestre.
Where have you been on your boat?
I've been, after a long time in Polynesia, to sail from Marquisas to Tuamotu and all that, I have been around the world to come back in France, and I bought a house in Brittany, but it was too cold, and now I come back to Polynesia.
Can you tell us about your experience on the way to Polynesia?
Yes, okay. He was going with two young kids, backpack. One was a girl, a Spanish girl of 23, and another guy was Canadian. And I took them to Esmeralda in Ecuador, and we stopped after Las Perlas to a bay, Piña Bay, where it was military there. And the day after, the current was not so good against us, and the wind also. We stopped in another bay, 12 miles south of Piña, where it was a completely desert bay, beautiful bay, like in Marquisas, you see, very beautiful. And we stopped a few hours there to rest. And suddenly, when we were on the beach, three of us, to drink a coconut, we saw three black people, nude nearly, with just asleep or something on sex. And they have machine gun, and they took us under the trees there, and they say, now stay there. They came on the boat, they took me on the boat with them to move the boat, and they spoil us completely, all the thing, all the food, all the equipment, or everything they can find. They put in bags and put in their dinghy with the engine, and they were eight altogether.
So eight men with automatic weapons.
Yes, eight men with automatic weapons. I think Kalashnikov or something like that.
How long did it take them to offload all your gear?
It was in the afternoon of the 3 of October at 16 hour when they took us. And at night, all was finished. They took everything they got. And they say, now follow us. And they bring us with a machine gun in the back. You say, now take your boat there and follow us. And under the moon, we were going to Colombia, to the south, along the coast. And suddenly, the girl, who was clever, in fact, genius, I can say to the guy who was at the tiller of my boat, say, you see, this boat is a metallic boat. And, the warship with generally in Piña Bay has a powerful radar, and he saw now actually where we are going, and they will follow you, and they will arrest you. It was a panic on the thing, and they disembark in 5 minutes in their dinghy, and they say, go away, go away. And it was finished. We were very happy to because we could be completely spoiled and sequestered, perhaps.
So right up to that moment, you were in fear for your life. You thought that you may be killed at that point.
Oh, yes, we were very afraid to be killed or to be exchanged against a ransom or any kind of thing like that. Donc, at this time, we were free, and we could join in 3 hours Piña Bay and make a declaration to the police, you see.
And what did the police say? How did they take this?
But they say, it's not Panamanian, it cannot be Panamanian, it's Colombian people there. But I'm not so sure, because it's really near of the frontier, and it can be some young Panamanian with, like Chief, a Colombian guy, you see. Kind of guerrilleros, you see, but they do everything. It's terrible.
Did you read about this bay, or did you find any information on it before you went in?
Yes, I have the guide of Panama. You see, the nautical guide, and they say it's very safe bay. It's not beautiful. You can anchor on the north or in the south, and it's very sheltered and everything good. Okay, it was not absolutely. I say it's far from Colombia, no problem. Donc, I was very astonished.
Did the police in Bahia Pinos, did they go looking for these men or did they do anything?
I don't know actually, but they intend to do it. They tell me, we will go there, we have the warship, we will make a survey, and if we find something, we will make a message to the French embassy to say if we find your stuff and all that.
And did you feel safe in Pinos?
Oh, yes, in Pinas you have the Star Lodge, completely illumination at night. You see, it's a very safe place with a lot of boats there at the anchor, generally with a military boat also anchored there. So it's very safe, Pinas and Jarque too.
And you were just 12 miles south of Bahia Pinos.
Yes. It's a good bay of Guayabo, beautiful bay, 12 miles south of Bahia Pinas, yes.
And what was the reaction of your backpackers?
But the poor girl, all the afternoon when she was with banditos, she was shaking her mouth and all that, completely panicked, you see. She only took some confidence in her when she was coming back at the night time on the boat, and she feel more safe on the boat with me, with the captain, with the friend also, Jonathan. Donc, she has this marvelous idea to speak about the radar, yes.
Yes, because in many ways you would think that would be more scary for the girl than for the guy.
Oh, yes, naturally, with this old this guy, you see, young kids, you see, and really not good, yes, banditos, yes.
What type of things did they take from the boat?
They took the Mariner 30 horsepower, they took the GPS, they took every suit, blanket, all the thing I had, you see, even the bucket, the cocotte minutes, the cooking, you see, the cocotte, all the camera, all the appareil photo, jumel, comme ça s'appelle, yes. A lot of things, you see, a lot of things. All the food, don't we have no more food? The police gave us some food to come back to Panama.
And this was, of course, the Darien province.
Yes, it's Darien province. The police explained me that it's difficult because it's not so far from Colombia and a lot of guerrilleros stay there when they have the problem in their country and it's the jungle. What?
Pirate attacks around Colombia, they're beginning to get, rampant and often. Do you have any advice for people that find themselves in this situation?
No, now I will tell. Go away of the coast. You need more than 50 miles or 100 miles. Don't stay nearby the coast. It's the only thing you can say, I can say now. And I will go now at the end of the month to Tahiti, but I will go straight to Marquesas. I will not even stop in Galapagos.
In retrospect, when you think back on this, is there anything that you could have done once you realized that there were men with machine guns, or by then it was too late?
I think it's too late, except if you are going to the beach, you see, with machine gun yourself, perhaps you can fight, and at this time you are not a pleasure man, you are guerrilleros too, and you fight with them, you see, but I think it's no problem when you are like that, nude yourself on the beach, and people come with machine gun, what you can do.
Yes, what can you do at that point? Do you have any other thoughts on this?
No, I think it's an experience, but it's not good. I don't like, you see, I like to fight with the sea, with the ocean, but when you fight like that with people, it's stupid and dangerous.
And Johan, this pirate attack took place in October 2003. Has this changed the way that you feel about Panama?
No, but I enjoy the life in Panama. You see, I'm happy here in town or in Las Perlas, but be careful when you go nearby the Darien.
Well, thank you very much. And that was Johan talking about his experience in the Darien province of Panama, suffering a attack by machine gun wielding guerrillas from presumably Colombia. And now, the next part of our program, we're going to air an interview with Martin Mitchinson. Martin just returned from a year-and-a-half-long trip into the Darien region of Panama with a dugout canoe.
My name is Martin Mitchinson, and I'm from Canada. I'm a,
sailor and a traveler, and like 10 million others, I'm trying to do a little bit of writing in photography and understand a little bit better where we are and why things are happening the way they're happening. When I first went down into the Darien, it was with a sailboat. A big part of that was just to see a part of the world that, for some reason, they hadn't been able to build a road through it yet, and to get a taste of some of the indigenous groups, the Bunan, the Embera, and the Kuna that are living in the area. But by the time I got down there, started to see a little bit more, I realized that it was a lot more complicated of a situation, things were going on down there. There were battles for land and for forest, and a lot of different viewpoints on how people wanted to manage this tiny space of land that hooks Central America to South America. Because of that, a number of different other reasons, I ended up selling the sailboat and continuing on by dugout canoe and by foot and cargo boats and whatever else could take me up into higher up in the rivers, up to the headwaters of Rio Balsa, Rio Tuira, and Sabana, and these other some that you know as well already. And so now, at this point, I'm working on some writing. I'd like to put a book together concerning the trip, but also a lot focusing on the politics of land down there. There's a lot of different groups that are struggling, some working together, many directly opposed, with plans to either protect or utilize or produce or whatever on the land that remains down there. The government itself, the ANAM, the environmental department and the national park, the Darien National Park, have one viewpoint. Private conservation groups such as ANCOM operated on a number of different levels too, and then there are the indigenous groups that have been there for varying 50 years to 200 years, depending on who you talk to, that have moved into the area after the Spaniards had cleared out the original population, and the colonos, cattlemen and workers from other parts of the country that have now run out of land in Chiriqui and Santos have all moved in now and cutting forests and to sell the timber and then turn it into cattle land, which lasts for a certain period of time until they can't even support cattle ranching. And so there's just, and as well, two people extracting, strictly there to extract wood and leave or gold, the minerals. So there's just so many different forces in there working all at different levels and leading to violence at this point and a lot of conflict and I don't see a clear way out at this point anyway.
Well, this is September 2003. Tell me about the violence.
It's at low levels right now, but it's there mostly along the highway. The last stretch of highway between Panama and where the Pan-American Highway ends in Yavisa on the Chuquanaque River. And that stretch is the highway improves, more and more people move in. It gets easier and easier to access to get in. It's easier to cut timber and pull it out. So you have one part of the indigenous community that isn't included in the comarca lands, the lands that were granted by the government under different laws over the last 80 years or so. The percentage of that population lives outside of those and have no guarantee, no land title. And so they're working in a program called Tierra Colectiva, trying to title their land, but in a communal form so that it can't be sold off bit by bit by bit. Meanwhile, the other groups in the area contest this, and they say, our indigenous population already has too much land, and this will give them 70-80% control of all the province of Darien, whereas their population doesn't merit that sort of percentage. So these people have, working with a Danish NGO, have brought surveyors in, marked all their land claimed areas around each one of their communities. This isn't the law yet, and so groups will be coming in, and some of them illegal Colombian refugees, some, like I said, from other provinces, land-hungry areas, have moved in and have started to clear lands that they claim aren't utilized. The indigenous population say they use about a 7 or 8 year cycle on their agriculture. Well, they'll clear 1 year plant, they'll burn it after clearing it, and they'll plant rice or corn, nyami, yuca, and then they'll leave it sit for 7 years while it recuperates from this. Other areas they leave and they don't clear at all because they use it for chunga, tagua, and other plants that they use for their house construction. So they just need to continue to use palms off of these things, or they use the palms to make the chunga strips that they build their baskets out of, or a cocobolo. Then they harvest bit by bit, or they leave areas untouched too that are around their water sources. And so when outsiders come in, they look at this land and it looks like nobody's using it. And they'll immediately clear it completely, sell off the timber, move cattle on, which contaminates the water in areas. I think, you know, in Boca Lara, where now they're finding their water sources contaminated with both human and animal excrement at this point, and so the sickness level has gone up. And whereas they had left that area around their water source, you know, for the last 100 years untouched, now it's cleared by people that have other uses for it. So this has led now to some Hunan groups bringing up, carrying arms and burning off crops of outsiders that have moved into the area and had confrontations in this way. Arimai as well, an area hotly contested between different outside groups and the population have closed the highways a number of times and have been conflicts between the colonos and the indigenous populations. And even on the comarca area itself, they were given their comarca reserve areas, but they can't move out the people that were there before the law existed. So even though it's an Indian, Embera Hunan comarca, there are still a large black Ladino population living in some of these communities. At the same time, claims at least that other illegal Colombian refugees are moving in and taking over lands that they don't have rights to, but the government not reacting. So a lot more conflicts even inside the comarca.
And when you say Colombians coming in, those are refugees from the conflicts in Colombia?
That's right. And most of them now are coming in on the Pacific Coast side, on Jaque, and moving up the rivers in those areas. Earlier it was coming down the Tuira River, a little more known now, Payampucuro, where a number of people were killed last January, the village leaders by paramilitary Colombian groups, and as well as the journalist Richard Pelton, Canadian-American journalist, that was kidnapped with two others and carried across to Colombia before he was released. But that area of Tuira has really been patrolled a lot more heavily now by the national police, and they're really restricting all movement. The higher village, Panusa, which was originally about 100 and 120 indigenous people, swelled up to 600, 700, 800, mostly with Colombian refugees coming more and more into there, and the police fearing that it was going to become a haven for people hiding themselves in this community. They moved everybody out and burnt all the houses, and the only building left there now is the concrete block school building. But I think what they want is that the idea that anybody moving now is a suspect, because they've moved as many people out as they can and moved them down to Boca de Cupe and other areas. So now if they see somebody in these regions moving, they know that they're probably illegal in some form or another. Tuira is becoming less and less people moving into there because of the danger, but still continues fairly heavy flow up on both coasts, but the Pacific coast in particular.
Talk about the journalist that was kidnapped and what happened and the outcome of that.
I don't know the full story, but Richard Pelton is someone who has made a living by looking for problems. He's written a couple of books, both entitled "The World's Most Dangerous Places to Travel" or something like this. His intention, normally, I think, is to find something that looks dangerous and go to it and then write an article about it. In the original interview I read with him shortly after this occurred, he had wanted to cross the Darien Gap, which is the area where no roads exist, and write an article about it. And he had been told by the police that and by the local communities that he could not go through or was not recommended. He found a guide, a fellow living in Capati along the Rio Tuira, that said he could get him there, no problem, don't worry about it. And so Richard Pelton hired this fellow along with another couple, a young American couple that wanted to go along on the trip as well. And so after they'd been turned around originally, they found back trails and skirted around the police stop checks and got as far as Paya, which is basically the last community before the open zone leading to Colombia. And there, again, those people told him no police in the community, but they said not to continue on and there are problems and they shouldn't be in that area. And they went off anyway. And short while later, after leaving Pyre, they met some people from the village running backwards, saying that friends of theirs had been shot and that there were paramilitaries in the area. Paramilitaries, Richard Pelt and his group stayed put where they were. Paramilitaries came, carried them into Colombia. Meanwhile, the paramilitaries went into Paya and they killed the two village leaders, I believe, of Pucuro and Paya. Four of the main leaders were killed at the time, apparently for giving aid at some point in time to FARC guerrilla groups that were passing in the area. Pelton and the others were released on the other side. At that time, the paramilitaries were having supposed peace talks with the government, and I think wanted to show that they were. They claimed they never kidnapped these people, but they escorted them to safety. And so they were carried across and delivered to a human rights group in the Colombian side. Pelton said in the aftermath that he said in the interview that because this area was a danger zone, because there were FARC guerrillas and paramilitaries, this is what attracted him to go into the area. So it was just later, I think he's revised that version. Someone who went into an area looking for trouble and he found exactly what he wanted and he wrote the story in National Geographic and decided to publish that in their adventure magazine. So that's your form of adventure.
How does Panama, a country without a military, deal with a border conflict the size of Colombia?
Just labels, being put on labels. There is just a national police force. The groups that work in the Darien are a special group of the National Police Force, called the Border Patrol or the Border Police. So they have other training that enables them to deal with the rainforest, the jungle areas, and the long patrols in open areas. So it may be just labeled as a police force, but their role out there is probably resembles more what a soldier would do than what a police would do, just because of the topography and the lack of roads and the lack of access. I've been up to the headwaters of a number of the rivers, far past where the roads end, within maybe, 12 miles of the Colombian border. I mean, that's part of the crossing. I think when I first wanted to come down to the Darien, maybe 20 years ago, that was, I was just burning desires to go across this roadless section and get into Colombia. And it was like a notch you put on your belt or something. Now I believe that you would learn nothing more by doing that. Other than how you deal with fear. To me, it's just a question of, it's like, Pelton's trip is basically the idea of putting yourself into danger because you want to say you went into a dangerous place, because you won't learn anything more, definitely about the situation there. And if anything, you just run this, spread your risk over all those who you take with you at the time. So I don't really have any desire. I have an interest in going to Colombia, and I have an interest to continue traveling the Darien and to actually go across. I don't think it's a wise move right now here.
Martin, would you talk about your dugout and who built it and what it's like traveling in a dugout canoe in the Panama's Darien province?
I didn't build the dugout. I bought it from somebody else that had partially completed it and then worked on it to complete it a little bit, what was left. And I love to travel by paddle. The locals up there think it's ridiculous because to them, a gringo, a white face, obviously has enough money for an outboard and a larger boat. Why would you paddle? And in fact, I did buy an outboard when I first moved there, but I'm in the process of selling it to somebody else because I just was never using it. I love the shapes of the dugout canoes there. Whether they're actually originally indigenous shapes or whether they got mixed with the African elements that moved into the same time, Columbus and Balboa, they were already very shortly later were through slave trade and through other navigators on some of the early ships, a lot of African elements. And I think they brought some of their own design and artwork too. So that the paddles in the piragua, the dugouts, are just works of art. They're just beautiful shapes that look like they're moving and flowing, even when they're just, sitting on the sand or leaning against the wall. The paddles themselves are like a shape of a leaf, and you can see the individual adze marks, and even after they've been somewhat planed down, just it just adds texture. It looks like a living, growing plant. It has a beautiful feel in your hand. So I love traveling by them because you see the bird life, which is incredible in that area, and you see the animal life often, too, that you'll never see with an outboard motor running. I travel a lot better down with current than I do against the current. The people up there are those that still do continue to travel by paddle and by pole when they're poling upriver, can push up long distances against current day and night working that way. I have a little bit of experience with that now, but my first efforts of that, someone teaching me to pull up river, I spent more time picking myself back up out of the river and getting back in the boat. But I like to travel up there. You still have the 15, 18 foot, up to 20 foot tides pushing, far up these rivers. And so if you you wait and you travel with tidal flows coming in and out, you can go, quite a ways up the river before you start meeting, just strictly the head current coming down. So you're able to travel that way, too. You always just have to be able to find a safe spot to wait out the shift current, especially during this rainy season. And I have had a couple of them, once with the sailboat, and then just recently with the dugout canoe tied in a bad place when a flood current came down in the middle of the night, bringing down all sorts of deadheads and logs and debris. And with the sailboat, I got hammered quite a bit and I ended up having to dragging down the river until I got stuck on a sandbar for a period of time. And with the dugout, it even got a little dicier still, partially swamped and in the dark of the night tied to a tree, which is the stupidest thing to do. I had assumed it would be a mellow night with not much of a tidal current, but when the flood came down from the higher mountains, it made it into a mess that hammered the boat, pushed the bow under, filled the boat, lost some goods over the side, and feel lucky to have been able to cut away the line and bail out the boat, just float on the river for the rest of the night. So I don't know, it's good and bad. I'm a clumsy traveler in a lot of ways, but I'm still alive.
Well, now, normally when you think about a picture in your mind of a lone gringo paddling upstream in a dugout canoe, it always seems like a missionary saving souls or something. I mean, what do the locals think when you show up?
That's a perfect question, because that's been one of the most difficult things, especially when I first went down there. I didn't really know why I was down there. I didn't necessarily want to work on a book. I wanted to stop trying to record and stop trying to take photos, because I think half the time you miss the experience when you're trying to get it down on paper or on film. But that was the question. They don't seem to accept the idea that someone can be just wandering around there conociendo, like just knowing, just traveling to know. That doesn't really make sense to them. And so that was the question that I would have wherever I would go. What is your mission? ¿Cuál es tu misión? And that's a good question for all of life. Like, why are you here? Why are you doing this? At first it was difficult to answer. And when you can't answer that question clearly, they get very suspect. Is this guy looking for gold? That's fresh in their minds from only 500 years ago. The assumption is a gringo wants something. Either he wants to save a soul and convert somebody, or he wants to, find minerals, or he's looking for wood, precious woods. Or he's buying artisan works to resell in his country. And so that was a real hurdle at the beginning, until I started to make contacts and start to feel stronger about the writing project. And then it made more sense. But the people there are, because of their, I think partially because of their exposure to NGO groups and United Nations and other groups, there is an expectation that they're looking for something a lot in a lot of places. And it's understandable. If I was, had travelers coming into my country with, just nothing but a country full of millionaires walking in, I would be thinking in my mind, how could I, make something out of this, as well. But so it's something I have to deal with everywhere I go. I know that people know I'm working on a writing project, but at the same time they're wondering, how can I get something either for my community or more often, how can I get something for myself or my family, either by working for this fellow, in some way, as a guide, which whenever possible, I like to be able to use, local people to help me out in one way or another, and to provide a little bit of employment. But often, working on my own budget and out of my own pocket, I don't have anything to offer, other than advice on questions, my labor with a machete, which isn't very efficient, and so I'm asking for a lot of charity in a lot of ways, a lot of help from people to help educate me with history, with culture, and hopefully I can return some of it in helping them too. Right now, develop their own project to record their history and their culture, something they haven't ever done, something written and recorded that way. It's always been an oral tradition which has been lost in this day of television and radio. And so hopefully I can return some in that way. It's a difficult thing wherever you go to. People don't understand why this fellow would be here. Not only come into their village with a paddle in a dugout, but keep coming back and be there for a year or 2 years. Or so it doesn't make a lot of sense to most of them. I find traveling through the Darien, I think I'm a lot of ways I'm learning plenty about the Darien, about the history and the culture and the ongoing politics. At the same time, it's been a real personal journey. Asking myself why we're living the way we're living, why do we turn our back on what could be a lot more comfortable and secure position in Canada, the States, or wherever we originate, and so that's continued to struggle. I mean, I sold the sailboat at this part, which was part of the life and the travel. I find myself single again, and so I wrestle with a lot of those things. And I think in some ways it becomes clear. Just the thirst for knowledge and understanding is to me a worthwhile enterprise, even when it doesn't involve receiving a degree or a monthly check. But on this trip, I think what I've wrestled with more than anything has been fears down there, partially because of the reputation of the Darien, which involves drug traffickers, Colombian guerrillas, and just theft, and a certain frontier sense of lawlessness because of its isolation. And sometimes I think that it's all paranoia, and that I can get over it. And yet, when you're on a river bank somewhere, an isolated river, and you're camping, you have to spend the night, wait for a tide to change, or got hit by a scorpion, so I couldn't hold my paddle one day, and it was just a long series of things. But you're camped on a riverbank in an area where you know there are caiman and crocodile, where you know there are different cats and things that in your own country you get to know your own animals and your own environments. When you're in somebody else's, they have this unknown about them where you don't really know if you're treading in the right place or the wrong place. And then on top of that, you also know you're in an area where the police have told you there are occasional passages, at least, of guerrillas, of narcotraficante, of drug traffickers, and of paramilitary groups, and just common theft. Here's a white face that's been in their neighborhood for a long period of time, and you don't talk that much to too many people about exactly where you're going because of this fear, sometime that you become a mark. And so I start to wrestle with, is this just paranoia? Am I letting all the government reports, the embassy reports and warnings get to me? Because, you don't try to be reckless, but, you try to go after what you want. And then now, at this point, I've met up with somebody who was a Panamanian that was kidnapped out of Metatee, which is on the highway right beside the largest police quartel in the Darien, and you could throw a stone and hit it from where this man was kidnapped. And he wasn't an exceptionally rich man or anything. A family that was solid, had a number of businesses, but and some land. But this has happened in 1999. He was kidnapped and held for a year and 2 months while his family liquidated everything they had in order to pay his ransom. And it's the same. A month earlier than that, another fellow in the same village of Metatee was kidnapped. This fellow did see him briefly when he was in Colombia, in the FARC camp. But then the first fellow that was kidnapped is believed to have been killed because he never did. They've lost contact, and he was never allowed to return. And so you realize this is in an area I would consider one of the safest areas of Darien to be. You know, established town on the highway beside the police barracks is about as close to Panama City as you can be in the Darien. Easy access, telephone, and yet here were these people kidnapped out of this village. And his sense was that the first three that came with the guns to take him away were likely locals working with the FARC, and he was taken a certain distance across into the forest and handed over to three others. And his belief is that the FARC works with local people so that there's no suspects, no strangers wandering through that could trigger alarms. And so, you know, as I became more and more relaxed and comfortable now, some of that resurgent fear comes back, and you look in everybody's eyes and you try to see, you know, is this character thinking about what he could make if he, you know, if I was carried off or not? And so it's fears on different levels, and that tires you out. And it's only because you have something to lose, I guess, that you become a mark. But at a certain point, you wonder whether you've spent enough time there at this point, and you should finish the project up and move on, like most gringos that earlier were living in the Darien. Majority of them have moved out of that area now and have either abandoned their properties or, you know, hope to return to them in the future.
And next we're going to be talking to the crew of Farniente, who brought their catamaran to the capital city of the Darien, La Palma. And from La Palma, they carried on in a ponga. So welcome to the program. And I see you have your grandchild with you. How'd your grandchild take the Darien and the experience here?
Yeah, he was embarrassed almost from the beginning, you know, when we got there, you know, because the first it was the kids that greeted us, and most of them had clothes, some clothes on, but most of them were totally nude. And then the women just wore a little sarong, you know, a little wrap around their waist, and no tops. So he was a little, you know, embarrassed, you know, how 11-year-olds are.
Yeah, absolutely.
but they were very, very tiny people, very friendly. We had a host or a greeter or something like that that's designated by the tribe to meet us. And then he took us to the meeting house. It was...
He's like the chief of tourism.
Is that what he was?
Yeah,
chief of tourism. And he led us up to a large hut on stilts that had a pole with notches in it for a ladder to go up. And once we got up there, there was tables, and you know, and it was a big area. And he said that was a meeting house, and that all the women would bring their wares, you know, their baskets and their carvings and that sort of thing. They would bring all those to that meeting house for us. And it didn't take very long, and about 40 or 50 of them showed up.
Yeah, they all just came from all over the village, the children, the mothers, everyone showed up with all their things. And the men make the togas, not the women. So the women make the baskets, the men make the togas.
The carvings?
The carvings out of the nuts, out of the nutshells. And... you know, but the men do the negotiating, and the women have the final say in the price. So if you negotiate a price for something, and they don't trade for large baskets, they definitely know what the U.S. dollar is. So when you go to them and you take a gift or whatever to trade, if you're going to take a dress or clothes or something like that, it has to be something that they want or need, or they won't trade you. And even if it is, like we were told to take bras and infant clothes, which we did. The bras were the funniest part, right?
Yeah.
Because the women didn't know how to wear them. They don't wear bras. They don't wear tops. So they didn't know how to try on the bra. One of the women tried to put one on, but she put it on upside down. So we were all kind of gathered around, and our friend Margie gave her a lesson on how to wear a bra. So she put it on, and then she put it on and wore it the rest of the day. She was so proud of her bra. And then another lady took one, and she just kind of took her breast and kind of dropped it into the cup and looked at the other women all around to get their approval. And they go, yeah, it looks good. So she goes, okay, we'll take it. You know, and so she went back to her hut to pick out, that one was my bra that we gave her. She went back to her hut to get a gift or a trade for me. They brought us carved turtles and crocodiles and birds and things like that. They were really nice. So we were quite happy with the trades. But they don't trade you for the baskets that sell for, you know, $350 or and up to $1,000 or more here. So the clothes and the things like that are trades for the little tiny baskets and the, you know, the carvings, things like that. And if they're not happy with your price, they'll definitely say no and stick to it. They won't give it away. They know the value of the price here. So anyone going in there thinking that they're going to get a basket that sells on the market for $350 to $1,000 is not going to trade it for a pair of shoes. You know, it's not going to happen. They have to be willing to fork out the money. And they start, their bidding usually starts at about half of what you see it marked at in retail. And then you can usually go down, depending, I'd say maybe close to half of that. And what I did, there was a basket, this large basket here that I really wanted, but she started out at $180, and I there was no way we could do that. I said, no, we can't do that. So walked away, and she goes, no, and she walked away from me. You know, and she just turned around and put her hands up, and that was it. She wasn't going to bid anymore. She wasn't going to talk about it anymore. So went around, and I told Bob, well, I really don't want the others. You know, this is the one I want. So if I can talk to her, maybe we'll do it. To Bob, you know, and I'm just going to talk to her woman to woman, okay? So I went over directly to her and said, you know what? I really like this basket. It's beautiful work that you've done, and it's the one I really want. But my esposo will not give me any more money. And that's it. He goes, no, no more. This is all I can have. This is all he will give me for this basket. So if you were willing, I'd really, really like to have your basket. It's a beautiful work that you've done. And this is all I can afford. It's $100. And she said, okay. So she gave me the basket. Other thing is with the children. One of the things that our friends on Pendragon had told us was that to be careful with the babies, because the women run actually are like the boss. They're the overseers of most everything. So we were cautious of the babies when we got there for two different reasons. One is they often have scabies, and another is that if it's a male child, they're not valued the way a female child is. So if you pick up a male child, you're likely to have a real problem giving it back to them. And one of the babies that the women wanted to sell me for $1, it was a male baby, she wanted to sell him to me for $1. And obviously you don't want to walk out of there with one of the, you know, one of the babies. Oh, the dancing was fun. The ladies, well, actually, the chief of tourism came out, and he wanted us all to pay $5 to watch the ladies dance after we finished purchasing our baskets. So we were trying to determine if he meant $5 per lady that danced or $5 for the whole show. Well, but before that was settled, we realized that the women, all the women were yelling at the man, and we couldn't quite figure out what was going on. And then we realized, because our friend that was with us, Marjorie, spoke Spanish, she said that the women were upset because they didn't want him charging us anything, that they were so appreciative of us buying the baskets from them that they wanted to do a dance for us in appreciation for us coming there and doing that. So they all got together, and they got in a circle, and they held each other's arms around their shoulders, connecting like that. And one lady was playing her drum, and they were dancing around. And then pretty soon, one of the ladies left the group, and she came out and grabbed my arm and dragged me into the dance. So I was dancing around in the circle. And then they went and got Marjorie and dragged her in, finished the dance. And then they went up to get Seth, our grandson, who did not want to go in. He was yelling for Grandpa to help him and putting his feet in the... He was putting his feet in the dirt. He didn't want to go in to dance with the women. So then the ladies grabbed the two grown men, who was both Bob's, and brought them into the dance, and their dance was different. With the men, they opened up. They didn't complete the circle. They opened up their dance differently with them.
The only thing that was really funny is that they were so short. One part of the dance, you had to go and then make turn around, and we kept hitting them in the head with our elbows, so we had to keep our elbows up, and then they were totally clear underneath. They were that short.
I would say they shouldn't probably advise against taking their sailboats far into the Darien, but anchoring in La Palma is an excellent place. Plus, they have a very large national police substation there that guard things. And we were very welcome. The people were really warm and friendly and welcoming us to their village. And the policemen were all very friendly and welcoming us. But when you get up in the Darien, there's too many obstacles that could get into your way. The river's narrow, and it's very muddy. The jungles come out. It gets very shallow in some spots. And, you know, when you get up to where the tribes are and you're in their way with your big boat, I don't know if there would be a problem with them maybe wanting to come onto your boat. I could foresee all kinds of problems that might happen if you took your sailboat. So my advice would be to leave your sailboat anchored in La Palma and hire a guide the way we did to go up. Plus, they know the territory. You know, they know the people. They know the language. You know, and speaking, communication is everything. If you can communicate with them and whatever happens, then you can probably be okay.
We took one of the longest trips, you know, 27 miles up in the river. That's probably one of the furthest villages that a guide would be able to take you to. And we still paid under $100 for the whole day. And considering that gas is $2.50 or better a gallon out there, you know, that was a pretty good bargain for an hour and a half in each direction. So he was 3 hours with that outboard wide open. And, you know, I know that used up a lot of gas. So we would recommend that, you know, if we went back, we would do the same. We would go to La Palma, anchor there, and then hire a guide to take us to a different village. But, you know, you could do that numerous times, and end up going up different rivers and, you know, different tribes are in there. But I wouldn't recommend taking the boat itself up in the river very far, and because between La Palma and that village, we didn't see anyone.
There's also a lot of forks in the river. It would be easy to get lost, and some sides of the forks, as our guide Maximilian was explaining to us, get really shallow, like a foot deep. And they look deep, but they're not. And at certain times of the day, they get very, very shallow, and other times they're not. So, and also there's crocodiles in the water there and stuff. So, you know, you don't want to get up there and have a problem, have to dive down in the water and fix your prop or something. You know, it's not.
Well, the only thing that we could, you know, we would liken it to a National Geographic experience. That's really what it was like. I mean, there was no electricity, no running water, no, you know, the houses are on stilts. There wasn't one door in the whole place or window. You know, the huts had a roof, and then they were open.
Yeah. And the only other thing too is that I would just highly stress that people be careful about being respectful to the people. I mean, the women are topless and stuff, so as far as, like, taking pictures, I did notice that I wanted a picture of the person who made my basket. So I asked the woman that made my basket if I could take her picture, and she reluctantly said okay, and I wasn't really given it a lot of thought, you know, and I took it, and as soon as about the time I snapped the picture, I realized she really was almost embarrassed. So later when we asked for a group picture, and they felt comfortable with that, but I don't think they're very comfortable with one-on-one pictures the way they are. She seemed really shy and didn't, but she was quite happy to do it as a group. So I would just, you know, suggest that people be conscious of, you know, looking at them and reading their body language.
And asking to take pictures before doing it, right?
Yeah. And the children, they love you to take the pictures of the children. You get the children together as a group, and they love for you to do that. They're very excited about having the children's pictures taken. And if you can show them on a movie camera or a digital camera or a portable camera, an instant camera, where you can give them a picture too, they really like that. It's just the women one-on-one by themselves, I could tell the sense that they were very uncomfortable. And as soon as we said a group, then they lightened up and they were fine.
Hi, this is Betty Biodiesel, and you're tuned to listener-supported Radio for Peace International, your global community forum.
This is Scott Fratcher, and you've been listening to Martin Mitchinson and the crew of Bamboo talking about the Darien region of Panama. Scott Fratcher is a graduate of the Institute for Progressive Communications, taught at the grounds of Radio for Peace in El Rodeo, Costa Rica. To find out more about Radio for Peace International or the IPC course, log on to the website www.rfpi.org, www.rfpi.org.
Hi, I'm Bob Banner, publisher of Hope Dance magazine, Radical Solutions Inspiring Hope, and we support Radio for Peace International Global Community Forum.